Hello and welcome to our CrossCast webinar series. My name is Katie Turner, and I'm the Education and Programming Coordinator here at Cross Financial. Today's topic is Advanced Medicaid Compliant Annuity Case Studies, hosted by Jim Woolerton, our Director of Legal Education here at Cross Financial. First, I have a few housekeeping items. If you have any questions during today's webinar, go ahead and type those in the questions section of the GoToWebinar toolbar so we can answer them at the end of the presentation. Next, a copy of today's PowerPoint can be found in the handout section of the GoToWebinar toolbar. We also ask that you please complete the post-webinar survey that will pop up on your screens at the end of the presentation, as this is a daily requirement or if you'd receive your certificate of attendance. And now, let's get to today's presentation. Jim, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks so much, Katie. Sorry, folks, for being a minute late. I moved my computer thing and it froze the whole thing. So that's on me. So I apologize. Today, what we're going to cover are advanced Medicaid compliant annuity case studies, just like the slide says, and where this particular course kind of developed was we were preparing for the annual NALA meeting. This year was in Seattle, and we wanted to kind of do something that was outside of kind of the standard single person gifted annuity strategy and the community spouse annuity strategy. And so we talked to the planners that work with you all every day, and we said, outside of those strategies, what are you guys seeing the most of when it comes to untraditional planning using the Medicaid compliant annuity? And so we came up with these three kind of alternative, non-traditional, advanced strategies. So that's kind of where this But I've already presented it once at NALA in front of people, so I got some good feedback from that. So you're benefiting from their feedback, and like Katie said, to get the CLE, please fill out that survey and give us feedback, and that helps me develop the curriculum and obviously present these webinars better. So I really appreciate you guys and your feedback. So thank you all for being here today. It's an honor to present this particular topic, because I do find it very interesting, and we'll kind of take our time and work through some of these case studies. But before we get going, for those of you that don't know who Kraus Financial is, we are an attorney-led firm that provide asset preservation solutions for estate planning and elder law attorneys and their clients. And we use specialized products, and the one we'll be talking about today is that Medicaid-compliant annuity. We also offer long-term care insurance. If you're doing proactive planning, that's something that I'm trying to build more and more education for attorneys on as well. So we do the Medicaid compliant annuity, funeral expense trust, then the long-term care insurance. If you have clients that need those policies or get some quotes, you can reach out to me, and I'll get you in touch with our staff that has years and years of experience doing that type of work as well. So you can see we handle lots of these cases every month, 400 plus cases monthly. And that's where the different strategies come from, is directly from our planners that work directly with attorneys on a day-to-day basis. So kind of the way that this webinar today is structured is we'll start out with talking about the Medicaid-compliant annuity and how it's most used. We're not going to get into Medicaid qualification requirements in this because it is more of an advanced course. So if this is all new to you, that's okay. We have lots of resources on our attorney access platform on Medicaid qualification and things like that. So we're kind of fast forwarding through that and getting into strategies. And then, like I mentioned earlier, we identified some unique cases that do warrant a bit of a different approach while using the Medicaid compliant annuity. We'll kind of talk about those from an overarching kind of high level, 10,000 foot view. And then we'll do some case studies and put some numbers to it, because with the case studies is where I really learn how the strategies come into play. Otherwise, it's kind of just an idea, an ephemeral idea, and I don't really understand it. But once you put some numbers to these, I think you'll find these will make a lot more sense. Again, like Katie mentioned, if you do have questions, put those in the control panel. When I presented this in NALA, we did have some time left at the end for questions. So hopefully that'll happen again today. So let's start out with the Medicaid compliant annuity and what it is. The Medicaid compliant annuity, and the reason why it's used in crisis planning, is because it allows the assets that are over the asset limits, the community spouse resource allowance, the individual resource allowance, and allows you to use the Medicaid compliant annuity as the tool to convert that asset that is causing disqualification and turn that asset into an income stream. And so that's going to be really important when we get into these advanced case studies to really focus on that's what we're doing, and we're going to use that in all the case studies. And the way that it works is it's an income only, so we're just creating income with it. Single premium, so you're paying all the money into the annuity at once, and it's paying out immediately, creating an income stream immediately, and it's written to comply with Medicaid requirements. So it's not the type of annuity that you would ever see a client come in using it as a financial product. Those more traditional annuities have deferred growth and balloon payments at the end. This is, and we'll talk about the five requirements of it, but it works because it complies with the Medicaid rules that are in 42-1396P. So it works in 49 states plus DC. The one state that is not available at this moment, and we're working on it, is New York. The terms can get as low as 2 months, minimum investment of $5,000, and no maximum issue age on those. So it's a very highly specialized product that you use in crisis planning. So again, it's used for getting the financial assistance of the long-term care Medicaid program, and how you use an annuity varies depending on the case facts. And I know you are all attorneys. If the answer is it depends on the case facts, and that's very similar to using this tool. But one thing that is consistent are the five main requirements of a Medicaid compliant annuity. And so for those of you that haven't used a Medicaid compliant annuity, these are those five requirements that are outlined in the federal statute and then are also outlined in state Medicaid manuals. So they have to be irrevocable, and this is irrevocable can be, where you cannot revoke or alter the Medicaid compliant annuity. Once it's in place, it's in place. There's no way to kind of back end any money out of it. It's non-assignable. So written into the contract of the annuity is it says that it cannot be transferred to another party or sold on the secondary market. So you can't move it from one person to another. It's irrevocable. You can't change ownership, and it has to be actuarially sound. Now, this is the requirement that prior to working at Kraus was for some reason very complicated for my brain to wrap its brain around. The term of the annuity has to be equal to or less than the owner's Medicaid life expectancy. So it has to be shorter than the owner's Medicaid life expectancy. Each state does approach this differently. More states are just leaning on the Social Security tables. And basically what those tables say is if someone's a specific age, then they're only expected to live so long according to those life expectancy tables. So just, I don't have the table in front of me, but you have somebody, let's say, who's 78, they might have, I'm just guessing, a 7-year life expectancy. And so the term of the annuity has to be equal to or shorter than the owner's life expectancy. It cannot be longer than, it can be shorter than. So we always have to think life expectancy minus months from that life expectancy. It can't be over the life expectancy. So I don't know why that was hard for me to grasp, but hopefully I was able to explain that in a way that makes sense. The payments coming out of that Medicaid compliant annuity also have to be of equal payments. So once this annuity is in place, remember it's irrevocable, non-assignable, has to be for a term that's less than the person's life expectancy. It has to pay out in equal payments. So it's a fixed income that's coming out of this annuity every single month. Can't have deferrals, can't have balloon payments. It's a very bland annuity for those of you that have seen other financial products like this. And then the big kicker and the reason why it's allowed in Medicaid planning is we're going to list the state Medicaid agency generally as primary beneficiary up to the extent of benefits paid on behalf of the Medicaid recipient, unless there's a minor disabled or spouse living at home. So we have to have the state as beneficiary so that if the person passes away, they've received Medicaid benefits, then the state is able to get paid back. It's basically an estate recovery type tool that the states have built in to these contracts so that they get money if the person passes away and they receive Medicaid benefits. And we're going to talk about why that's not necessarily as big a deal in some cases. So traditionally, now we're going to talk about what are the traditional strategies that we use with Medicaid compliant annuities. So in most cases with a married couple, kind of our default situation is we have one spouse has to go into the nursing home, and then we have one spouse living in the community. So when we see that, our brains trigger to, we're going to use a community spouse annuity where the community spouse purchases the annuity and they get paid back that income. So they're the owner of the community spouse annuity. That annuity is going to follow all those rules and pay that money back to them over the term of the annuity. And what that allows it, what allows to happen is any money that's over the individual resource allowance. Remember, that's $2,000 in most states. The community spouse resource allowance is around $157,000 this year. So any money that's above that $159,000, the community spouse purchases an annuity with those funds and gets paid back, starts getting paid back immediately through income. And then the institutionalized spouse is immediately eligible for long-term care Medicaid benefits to pay for their care in a nursing home. There's no gift in that situation. And what that results in is in that immediate eligibility. So that's kind of our traditional automatic when we're thinking about married couple community spouse case. We have a community spouse, we have an institutionalized spouse. We want to get the institutionalized spouse immediately qualified for Medicaid. We're going to get income back to the community spouse. One of those fundamental rules that we learn when we're first learning Medicaid planning is a community spouse's income doesn't matter. Institutionalized spouse's income just has to be lower than the private pay rate. Generally not a problem because those bills are very high. And so we can get folks, you know, qualified very quickly for Medicaid when we have a community spouse case. So that's kind of the traditional way to handle a married couple case. Now for a single person case, we don't want to do that same thing generally because we know one of those fundamental rules is an institutionalized person's income is going to go towards their Medicaid copay. Whatever income they have, minus a few deductibles, the personal needs allowance, medical deductions, things like being able to pay your insurance premiums, things like that. With a single person, everything else is going to go to the nursing home to pay for their care, and then Medicaid's going to pick up the rest of the bill once they've made their copay. So what we generally recommend for single folks is using a gift and annuity plan. And what we learn when we learn Medicaid planning is that if you have a gift, if you make a gift, you're going to be penalized. We figure that out. So what generally happens in those single person cases is the individual gives away about half of their assets and then uses the other half of their assets to purchase a Medicaid compliant annuity that's going to pay income to the institutionalized person, the individual, because it's just single person. And then that's going to give them enough income to privately pay through the penalty period until that penalty period is up. Then they qualify for Medicaid benefits and Medicaid starts picking up the difference between their income now that's been reduced because the annuity's gone and then the nursing home bill. So generally that, what you do the math, there are some variables, but it usually comes out about half of their assets going to a gift and the other to help pay for the private pay rate at the institution. And the benefit there is we're making an immediate defined wealth transfer. We're saying you came into my office, you were paying $10,000 a month, you were going to bring down your savings and you weren't going to be able to leave anything for your kids. And so with using a gift and annuity strategy, usually you can conserve about half of their savings and the other half goes towards paying for the penalty that you create by making a gift. So those kind of the traditional, and now we're going to mix them all together when we get into some of these different strategies. So now we're going to get into some different strategies that our planners have said they have seen most commonly outside of those. But we're going to use the concepts of those in the, and we're going to mix all these together and then we'll do some case studies. So the first one that we'll look at is what happens when both spouses go to the nursing home together. This one, you kind of think about it, you're like, well, they're married, but there's no community spouse. So the traditional community spouse rules don't apply. So we have to look into the federal statutes and the Medicaid manuals of your state to figure out how these are handled, and we'll walk through that. The second non-traditional kind of advanced Medicaid planning strategy is what happens when you have a client, maybe they're a younger client, they were in a car accident, they can't take care of themselves anymore, but then they get a settlement years later, they get on Medicaid, and then years later their personal injury settlement comes in and they get a big influx of cash, like the receipt of an inheritance is another way that happens, or the settlement money. How do we try to preserve some of that money while getting them back on Medicaid benefits as quickly as possible? So we'll talk about that scenario. And then the last one we'll talk about is, what if the client comes into your office, and I had a lot of attorneys ask me about this one before, and they kind of did their own Medicaid planning, DIY Medicaid planning, and they gave away a bunch of money to their kids within the five-year look back. The kids went and blew that money. They can't cure that gift to get rid of the penalty. So they're already coming in with a penalty period. And how do we work around that? So those are the three non-traditional kind of different scenarios that we'll look at. So let's hop into those, and we'll spend the rest of the time working through those three different situations that come up. So when both spouses are institutionalized, so we have both spouses living in the nursing home together, we call that double gifting. And we'll get into the reasons why. But we have both spouses are in the nursing home at the same time. We have no community spouse. So basically what we're going to do is we're going to look at that like a gift and annuity plan for a single person, but for two different people, where each spouse is divesting about approximately half of the assets by way of a gift, but each one has to do it. So we have each spouse then being subject to a penalty period of ineligibility. And then they're each going to purchase a separate Medicaid compliant annuity to pay for their care costs through their respective penalty period. So we're basically thinking like two single people for kind of a shortcut way to think about this. And they have to purchase two separate Medicaid compliant annuities due to how the penalty period is assessed in most states. And I'll show you kind of what language you're looking for in your Medicaid manual to see if this is how your state handles it. So why do we have to use this strategy is because when we're dealing with an institutionalized couple, the rules are different as far as the amount of assets, that's probably a better way to put it, that each person can keep. So the community spouse resource doesn't apply because there's no community spouse anymore. We have two institutionalized persons. And in most states, what the rules say is if you have both spouses in a facility, the couple could only keep $3,000. So that's way less than even if you had the traditional $2,000 to two individuals. That would be $4,000. Here, they're only allowing you to keep $3,000. So we have this very limited amount of assets the person can keep. Since both spouses are institutionalized, we don't have that CSRA. They don't have the spousal impoverishment protections anymore because no one's out in the community anymore. So basically, like I said, kind of the shortcut way to think about this is we'll treat them like two single people, and we'll use a twist on the traditional gift and annuity plan. So the reason that this is set up this way and what I'll walk you through works is because in most states, when both spouses are institutionalized, any gifts made by one spouse will result in both spouses incurring a penalty period. And that is then divided between the two individuals since one spouse cannot serve the penalty period on their own. So there's no like allocation of a penalty period. What the states say is we're going to divide that equally no matter who made the gift or which assets were gifted. Because remember, one of those concepts that we go back to when we first learned Medicaid is a couple is basically viewed as one unit for Medicaid purposes, regardless of how property is titled. So kind of an example to kind of wrap your brains around this concept is if the divestment penalty divisor in the state is $8,000, we have to think about doubling that. So a gift of $16,000 will result in a 1-month penalty period. we have to kind of double everything. So the numbers start to get big really quickly because we have to take the $8,000 in order to get a full month penalty period. We have to make a gift of $16,000. So when both spouses are serving the penalty period, and this is another key component to this planning, is if one spouse passes away, the other spouse picks up the remaining penalty period because now that gift, as opposed to being a unit, is just kind of latched on to the surviving spouse at that point. So if each spouse, we do this planning, each spouse has a 10-month penalty period. One spouse dies in month 5, the other spouse has a total penalty period now of 15 months remaining. So they received as a great gift that 5-month penalty period when their spouse passes away. So where is all this coming from and why do we have to think like this? Well, the first part of it comes out of 1396P, like we talked about. And basically it says the state has to use a reasonable methodology to apportion the individual, to apportion ineligibility among the individual and their spouse. And so each state addresses the topic a little bit different, but as we have worked through these cases, what we found is most states handle the situation the same. So we want to look in the Medicaid manuals of a couple different states so you can see what this language looks like as you're looking through your Medicaid manual if you have one of these cases come in the door. So in Wisconsin, it states that if the community spouse makes a divestment resulting in a penalty period for the institutionalized person, split the remaining penalty period between the spouses at the time the community spouse is found otherwise eligible. In Georgia, if the community spouse subsequently goes into LAD, which I assume is their long-term care Medicaid program, the penalty may be shared between the spouses. Should one member die, the remaining eligible spouse will complete the remainder of the penalty period for the now ineligible spouse. And then Arizona, that's kind of the most succinct, states that when both spouses qualify for ALTEX, which is the Medicaid program there, the penalty period is equally divided between the two spouses. So when you're looking to kind of see how your state handles these situations, because each state kind of has their own processes and language in their Medicaid manual, that's the kind of language that you're looking for. Okay, so we've kind of reviewed the scenario. We've reviewed the approach. Now let's do a case study on it, and this will bring it all together for us, hopefully. Here we have George, is 85 and married. So we have George has been in the nursing home for a few months, his wife Mary. She's about to move into the facility as well. Their children are concerned about using up the whole life savings, so they contact you, their local elder law attorney, for help. All right, we're going to come back to the case facts, but let's lay these out. So we have George's income is $2,400. It's a little bit higher than Mary's, which is at $2,100. Their total countable assets above the $3,000 is, or I don't know if we've done that yet. So their total countable assets, we'll just say, is $295. George's cost of care is $9,000. Mary's is the same. So we're paying two bills. So like I said, the numbers are going to add up quickly of $9,000 each month. And then we have in this state a divestment penalty divisor of $8,000. So the first thing we have to do, okay, so we didn't deduct out the $3,000 yet. So we need to figure out the spend down amount. So George and Mary can keep the $3,000 as their combined resource allowance. We're only going to leave them with $2,800 because we don't want them right on the edge of eligibility. So we're going to do the total countable assets of $295 minus $2,800, and we're going to result that with a spend down amount of $292,200. So we need to figure out what are we going to do with that $292,200 in order to get them eligible as quickly as possible. The first thing we have to do is calculate the burn rate. This slide is crazy. We show it because we want you to know that we know what we're doing behind the scenes, and if you want to calculate your own calculations, follow along with me. I'll do my best to explain it, but just know this is what's going on behind the scenes. If you have a case, you need to call us. We do the equations. A lot of it's based on it. A lot of the initial math will be based on this burn rate. So let's figure out how much the couple is going to burn through each month. And what we want to figure out is how short are they each month from paying their own nursing home bills, plus if we want to make a gift, how much money are we going to make of that gift that's going to equal a 1-month penalty? So then we can determine how long does a Medicaid compliant annuity need to be in order to pay through the penalty period we caused by the gift? So that's what we're doing here. The first thing we need to do is look at our combined cost of care. Because we have two folks, we have George's cost of care is $9,000, Mary's cost of care is $9,000. Our combined cost of care is $18,000. We subtract out the combined income. So again, we're combining everything here. So we have George's income is $2,400. We have Mary's income is $2,100. So our combined income is $4,500. So we have that coming in each month. So we take the combined cost of care, $9,000 plus $9,000, $18,000, subtract out their combined income of $4,500. So each month, they're going in and dipping into their savings account to pay $13,500 every month just to pay for their nursing home bill. So we know that's the income shortfall. We need to generate enough money out of an annuity to pay $13,500 each month. So what else are we spending every month? We know we're spending $13,500, but we also want to make a gift of $16,000 each month, which will equal one month penalty. And we get that number because we take the divestment penalty divisor in our state and we multiply it by two, because remember that foundational rule was we can't just allocate a penalty period. If we want to make sure that this gift is being allocated equally, which is the way the most states calculate it, we need to just double that. So we have a combined divestment penalty divisor of $16,000. So we know that every month we're spending $13,500 on the income shortfall so they can pay privately, because we're creating a penalty. So they have to pay their nursing home bill every month. And we want to give away $16,000 every month. Well, if we were doing it every month, we're going to do all the lump payments, but $16,000 is going to equal their per month gift, which equals a burn rate of every month of $29,500. So our burn rate is really large, and $16,000 is being consumed by way of gift, and $13,500 is being consumed by way of the annuity. So hopefully that's not as clear as mud, a little bit clearer. I know that's a real complicated slide. We've practiced on how to explain this, and that's as good as I've ever gotten. So hopefully that makes sense of our burn rate. That's what we're spending every month. So why are we using those double figures? Just to refresh, any divestment and resulting penalty period is going to be split between the two spouses using that Wisconsin language. Even though the divestment penalty divisor is $8,000, we have to double that amount in order for each to incur a full month of penalty. And each spouse, again, is responsible for paying their own cost of care each month. Their cost and income figures are going to be combined as well. So that's why those numbers get so big, because we're doubling our figures. So the next thing we're going to do is we're going to take that burn rate, figure that out, and that's going to help us figure out how long this plan is going to be. So remember, we go back to that spend down amount, $92,200. We divide it by the burn rate that we just calculated, and that's going to tell us how long the plan is. So that comes up with 9.9 months. We're going to round it up to 10 months just to be conservative. So now that we know the length of the plan, we know that we, for each month of gifting, we're going to give away $16,000. So we multiply the length of the plan by the combined divestment penalty divisor, and that's going to tell us that what we want to do is give a gift of $160,000 to get a 10-month penalty. So we're going to give away that amount, $160,000, and then the penalty period is going to be allocated equally between George and Mary, between the two of them. So we determine So we have the spend down amount of $292,200 is reduced by that gift of $160,000. That leaves us with $132,200 to fund into the two Medicaid compliant annuities. Well, it'd be a lot simpler. We could just divide it in half, but that won't work because they have different income amounts. Mary's income every month is $2,100, which is less than George's income of $2,400. So Mary's going to need more money every month from the annuity to make sure she can privately pay through her penalty period. So the premium amounts are going to be different because we need them to pay out a different amount. Someone asked, will you get the slides? They're in the material section of the control panel there. So we want to figure out how much George's annuity is. I know there's a lot of math here, and I'm sure you want to look at it again. It took me a while to wrap my head around all the numbers too. So we want to figure out how much George's annuity is going to be. We'll allocate $64,600 to him for 10 months. That's going to pay out $6,465. George is going to be the owner. Remember, to be Medicaid compliant, we have to name the Medicaid agency to the extent of benefits expended on behalf of George. And then we can name their children as contingent beneficiary. And then same thing with Mary, but hers is going to be a little bit higher. Remember, her monthly income is lower than George's, so her single premium is going to be higher. And it's going to create a higher monthly payout over the 10 months. Again, Medicaid agency is a primary beneficiary with a contingent to their kids. Okay, we've done the gift. We've purchased the annuities. Now we cannot forget to apply for Medicaid. We need to make sure that Medicaid knows to start the clock on those 10-month penalty periods. So after purchasing the annuities, George and Mary are both otherwise eligible for benefits. You're going to apply for Medicaid. Your clients are going to get that letter back that says, nope, you're not eligible for Medicaid benefits. They're going to freak out, come to your office. You're going to remind them that we talked about this. This was supposed to happen. I will reapply in 10 months after they serve the 10-month penalty. And then they're going to use their original income, the $2,100 and $2,400, plus the Medicaid compliant annuity income to pay the nursing home bill. So during the penalty period, they both have that same monthly care cost of $9,000. We added in purposefully a shortfall because we don't want to get too close to the edge to pay the nursing home bill every month. So they can use that. They can use a resource allowance, or hopefully whoever you made the gift to will pick up the extra, I think it was $135 every month. So we take George's original income of $2,400. We add in his income from the annuity of $6,465. And now George, every month for the term of that annuity, is receiving $8,865,000 in income. We know that that income is going to go to the nursing home. That's how he's going to privately pay through the penalty period. We have Mary's original income is $2,100. We need a little bit on a higher income for her. So we have $6,765 to get her new income amount up to $8,865 as well, using her original income source plus the annuity income each and every month is going to result in her almost getting $9,000 every month during the penalty period to privately pay through the 10-month penalty period. Once the 10-month penalty period has passed, George and Mary's monthly income goes back down to the $2,400 and $2,100 respectively. And then basically their income minus the personal needs allowance, we'll just say it's $50 in this state, is going to go as their copay. So George would have a Medicaid copay of $2,350. Mary's going to have a copay of $2,050. They'll each keep their personal needs allowance. The rest of that's going to go to the nursing home. Medicaid's going to pick up the difference, which means that they're saving $13,000, over $13,600 each month compared to when they came into your office. So this is why elder law crisis Medicaid planning helps clients so much see an instant return on their investment. Well, not instant, I guess, in this case. It takes 10 months, but it's pretty quick. A lot better than most legal services, I'll tell you that much. George and Mary were able to make an immediate wealth transfer of over $160,000, which ended up being over 50% of their spend down amount. Now, remember, in community spouse planning, we can usually conserve around 100, but because we have both spouses in the nursing home, we have to treat them both as a gift and annuity. We kind of back to that 50% kind of baseline. But in George and Mary's case, we were able to save over 50%. So great result for George and Mary. Rather than just spending down all their assets and then going on Medicaid when they're broke. So what if one spouse were to predecease the 10-month plan? Remember, that remaining penalty period is attributed to the surviving spouse. And if both spouses predeceased the plan, they wouldn't have gained or lost anything since they've been privately paying. And having Medicaid as their beneficiary on those annuities, so long as they haven't received previous Medicaid benefits, Medicaid wouldn't have a claim on those annuities. And so basically what the insurance company is going to say, well, we need to hear from Medicaid that says they don't have any claim to the money left in that annuity. And then it would be paid out to their children, I think is who we named as secondary beneficiary. But that could take some time. So we want to make sure that we're talking to the kids that, hey, we're going to gift you these funds. don't go off and pay off all your student loans with those. Hold those until we see how this plan plays out. And then obviously it's their money at that point. But we want to make sure where this plan can go awry is if one spouse passes away, the other spouse gets the extended penalty period and the gifted funds have disappeared. So we don't have any way to try to figure out how to pay through that while we're waiting for the insurance company to release the funds to the kids from the annuity. There can be some trouble there just because there is a delay in Medicaid telling the insurance company that they don't have a claim. Obviously, that's the case if they don't have, they haven't received previous Medicaid benefits. If they had, then Medicaid would make a claim against those funds. Okay, so that's kind of the most complicated, kind of non-traditional strategy. Again, if you have any questions around that, throw those in the question box in the question control panel. I'll do my best to clear that up. So the second scenario that we're looking at is what happens when the client is already on Medicaid and receives a lump sum inheritance or settlement amount, and they're going to lose their benefits because, you know, we're obligated to let Medicaid know that we have those funds. So here, you know, and this is one that comes up fairly regularly as well, is we have a client who's on Medicaid, gets that money, and yeah, I like the last one here, proceeds from the sale of their home. They didn't transfer the home into a Medicaid asset protection trust like you recommended. They keep the house. Kids are sick and tired of paying the maintenance on the house. They sell the house. It's still in mom's name. Whoops. Guess who's got a bunch of money now that we have to figure out what to do with. So this comes up fairly regularly because those funds will cause the Medicaid recipient to lose eligibility. In most states, they have to have less than $2,000. In this case, what we'll do is we'll do a gift and annuity to protect a portion of the cash, and the other portion, again, is they need to pay for care during the penalty period. So kind of going back to that gift and annuity strategy that we have. Here, one of the most crucial parts of this is making sure that we're timing this just right. So when this happens, again, folks on Medicaid are obligated to report that. So we're above the resource limits. We have to report that to the state. And then we want to time out the gift and the purchase of the annuity is going to follow the date that we get on our written notice of adverse action that says your benefits will terminate at the end of June, let's say if it's this month. And then so we want this strategy to go into effect in July. So we're going to line everything up with the date of the termination of Medicaid benefits. We're going to put this action, we're going to put this plan into action immediately after that termination date. We don't want to do it before because they're not ineligible yet. So we want to make sure that we're timing everything out just right. And again, our planners are great at working with attorneys to make sure that all of this is kind of lining up just right. So why do we use this strategy? Obviously, for single clients, it's kind of what we have to work with, and saving half their assets is better than spending it all down at the facility. For married couples, they might say, well, why don't we just transfer that to the community spouse and then buy a community spouse annuity? That's what some attorneys thought as well, but there's a case that came out that says you can't do that after someone's already received benefits. So the institutionalized spouse can only make unlimited transfers to the community spouse before initial eligibility is achieved. In this situation, they've already been approved for Medicaid benefits, so you can't make those unlimited transfers over to the community spouse after they've already received that initial eligibility and they've continually been on benefits. So that's why for married clients, we can't just give it to the community spouse. The community spouse purchases the community spouse annuity. The person that owns it kind of has to continue to own it, or inherited it, or got that settlement. And we'll talk about where that comes from. And you can't just refuse inheritance. That is considered a divestment in every state that I know of. And you would penalize for not receiving that amount. You can't just say, I don't want that anymore. And the state's going to say, well, you need to take that and spend it at the nursing home and get off of Medicaid if you're receiving those funds. So you can't refuse or avoid those funds. So that's why we have to use this strategy. The strategy that I was thinking of that would work, of just transferring it to the community spouse, was tried in Connecticut. So this is the Fagan case v. Bremby. Martin Fagan was riding his motorcycle. He had got severe injuries and had to go into a skilled nursing facility. He then applied for Medicaid benefits and started receiving them in 2012. And then 3 years later, he got his personal injury settlement from the motorcycle accident. It was a big check. So he paid some bills, and he still had over $1 million lost his coverage. So he said, Medicaid, I have this money. I'm going to lose my Medicaid benefits. So because this case wasn't out yet, and he had a elder law attorney that was smart, they thought, okay, let's transfer the remaining assets over to his wife because we know that intramarital transfers are okay before initial eligibility. And so they bought a house, and then they purchased a Medicaid-compliant annuity for the community spouse. Exactly what I think a smart, you know, attorney would do. But the state of Connecticut says, whoa, 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 can't do that. You can't make intramarital transfers to Mrs. Fagan after you've already been approved for Medicaid eligibility. You already received Medicaid benefits. So we're going to apply a penalty period. And it was big because it was such a large number. So his penalty period was 7 years. So big, huge penalty period. He doesn't have any money anymore. So he was giving the annuity and it's irrevocable, not assignable and all those things. So what are we going to do? We're going to appeal that case. And so they did so. And the court looked at it and it said that the key issue is the language of initial determinant of eligibility. They argued that they could still transfer assets because he was off of Medicaid benefits at the time. So the transfers are, again, pre-eligibility. State says, no, no, you've been continually institutionalized since 2012. And that's when you were initial, that's where that initial determinant of eligibility starts. And this later ineligibility doesn't trigger the new ineligibility determination. And so you can no longer make transfers to the community spouse above the community spouse resource allowance. And those are improper. So that's where the case came out. And that's why we can't just transfer those assets over to the community spouse. Unfortunately, that strategy doesn't work. These are the rules that we're working within. Why can't we just refuse inheritance? Because that was addressed directly in Transmittal 64 and in most state manuals. Again, if you look through state manuals, you'll find this language pretty much in all the ones I've looked at that states, for purposes of, I'll just read it because it's pretty straightforward. For purposes of this section, the term assets an individual or spouse are entitled to includes assets to which the individual is entitled or would be entitled if action had not been taken to avoid receiving the assets. The following are examples of actions that would cause income or resources not to be received: irrevocably waiving pension income, waiving the right to receive an inheritance, not accepting or accessing injury settlement. So those are specifically addressed in Transmittal 64, which, again, for those of you that might be newer, was the directives that came out after the DRA of 2005 and really laid the rules for most state Medicaid manuals. So, again, you'll find this in most state Medicaid manuals that you can't not receive an inheritance. I mean, that's kind of the first thing, right, that comes to your mind. Well, judges will take that money, and Medicaid doesn't like that. Okay, so let's talk through one of these. We have Robert. He's 82. He's been receiving Medicaid benefits for the last 6 months. His brother, who did not have any children, recently passed away and didn't go see an attorney before this happened, and Robert went on Medicaid. And Robert, of course, is the sole beneficiary of this estate, and he's set to inherit $155,000. So he's already on Medicaid. Now he's going to get a lump sum of $155,000. The case facts here: Robert's income is $2,350. Penalty divestment divisor in the state, $8,450. We have that inheritance amount of $155,000. We have Robert's cost of care of $9,600. So we're going to do the gift and annuity strategy. So again, we have to go back to what we did with George and Mary. Let's figure out the burn rate. So we're going to look at the cost of care is $9,600. His income is $2,350. So his income shortfall every month is $7,250, and the divestment penalty divisor in this state is $8,450. That gives us a burn rate of $15,700. So we know that $8,450 will be consumed by way of the gift, and then the $7,250 that we have to generate in income is going to make sure that Robert can pay his nursing home bill each and every month, and we total those together. That gets us $1,700 each month that's going to ultimately be each month that we're spending of that $155 that we have to work with. So remember, the purpose of the burn rate is to figure out the length of the plan. So we're going to take that $155 inheritance amount. We're going to divide it by the $15,700. And magically, we end up with 10 months again. The folks that make our slides are very good at math. So we calculate the gift amount. The gift amount will be $84,500 because we're going to take the length of the plan. We figured out was 10 months. We're going to multiply that by the divestment penalty divisor. And that's going to give us a total gift amount of $84,500. And that's going to result in a 10-month penalty period. So now we have to figure out how much the annuity, the single premium is going to be. After Robert makes the gift, the inheritance of $155,000 is reduced by the gift amount of $84,500, leaving $70,500. That's going to be a single premium paid in the annuity. The annuity term we know is 10 months because of the gift, and the monthly payout from that is going to be $7,055. Again, Robert's the owner. Primary beneficiary is the state to the extent of benefits expended on behalf of Robert. Ding, ding, ding. Well, Robert's already been receiving Medicaid benefits. That could be a problem if Robert predeceases this annuity. The contingent beneficiary is going to be the children. So again, we've made the gift. We've made the transfer. Robert's now otherwise eligible except for the gift. He reapplies for Medicaid and his penalty period begins. And then during the penalty period, he's going to use his Social Security income, the income from the annuity, to pay the nursing home bill. And that's going to be, his income was $2,350. The annuity income is $7,055. So the total income is $9,405. His cost of care is $9,600. So he is going to have a small shortfall to pay each month. Again, we talk to kids about that, or he uses his individual resource allowance to pay that shortfall. We just don't want to get him too close to the edge there. So what do we do here? We have Robert be penalized for 10 months. His income, we're going to bump that up to $94,500 to pay his cost of care is $9,600. And he was able to make that gift amount. Remember, that's the amount that we're saving, $84,500 over the inheritance. And that is 55% of the inheritance that he would have got. Had he not done anything, he would have had to just use that inheritance to pay at the nursing home. And the inheritance just would have been gone after 16 months. And then anything else would be subject to estate recovery. Again, the timing is going to be really critical here, where we want to make sure that we're reapplying for Medicaid after the termination date. Otherwise, it's just not going to make any sense. So we want to make sure that we get the timing done. And then kind of what I did, the ding, ding, ding thing on the beneficiaries, is unlike most traditional gift and annuity plans, should Robert predecease the annuity term and penalty period, the state's going to have a claim because Robert was already on Medicaid for 6 months. So they're going to have a claim as primary beneficiary of that. Generally, if we're dealing with someone who hasn't already received Medicaid benefits, that Medicaid's not going to have a claim. But in this case, we know they're going to have a claim for that 6 months that he was already eligible or already receiving benefits. Okay, so that's the second one. And now we'll do our final gift and MCA plan for a community spouse. Again, if you have any questions, throw those in the question control panel, and we'll get to those after this one. So why do we use this one? Again, in most states, when we have a married couple, we're using that traditional community spouse plan. However, some attorneys just use a gift and annuity plan for their married clients. And in this case, the community spouse keeps the community spouse resource allowance, and then we do a gift and annuity plan with the resources that are above the individual resource amount and the community spouse resource allowance. There's a couple of reasons to do it. The community spouse is in poor health. We want to make sure that they're living through the term of the annuity. If you have a blended family or second marriage, you want to make sure that we are making those gifts to their proper children, and maybe getting all the money back to the community spouse might not make the most sense if they have kids from a separate marriage or something like that. And then this one, I think, is probably the one that we see the most, is if clients have already, again, they did it themselves, Medicaid planning, they made gifts within the penalty period, and that money's gone. So there's no way to cure that. We want to figure out how we can get through the penalty period while maxing out the CSRA. And I think that's when this particular strategy is probably going to be used the most. With this strategy, you can use either spouse as the owner of the annuity, but you have to figure that out. If you're using IRA funds, the owner of the IRA has to be the owner of that. If you don't want to set up a QIT, if you're in an income cap state, that might make sense. And then we have to look at the beneficiary rules. If it's owned by the institutionalized spouse, the community spouse can be designated as primary beneficiary, which could be beneficial if the institutionalized spouse received benefits in the past. So this is kind of be a way to get around having to pay Medicaid as the primary beneficiary. So again, this one's pretty straightforward and we've kind of covered all these concepts. So we'll look at Carl and Linda. They're a married couple. Linda has dementia and has entered the nursing home. Carl's at home. So we have Carl at home, Linda the nursing home. They learn from a friend that they just give their money away. And that's the best way to get qualified for Medicaid. I can hear you laughing through your computers because you've had clients. But then the kids went and spent that money. And so we can't cure that gift. Obviously, that'd be the best way to deal with this. So they're walking into your office with a penalty period already. So what can we do? We can do a gift and an annuity to help Linda qualify for benefits faster than not doing anything and trying to figure out how to work around those previous gifts. So we have Carl's income of $2,400, Linda's income of $2,100, total countable assets of $325,000, Linda's cost of care is $7,800. The divestment penalty divisor is $8,000. And remember, they're walking in already having made a gift of $112,000. So let's kind of break this down. We have Carl as a community spouse is going to save he's going to keep $155,000. The community spouse research allowance is $157,000 and change. So we're going to keep him $2,000 below that just to be on the, avoid the edge of eligibility. Linda's going to retain her $2,000, meaning they have to spend down $168,000. They pay some bills, they make home improvements, and they purchase a funeral expense trust. We can provide that at Kraus Financial. And so that leaves Carl with $100,000. But we have, remember, we have these previous gifts that are going to be, Linda is going to be ineligible for benefits for 14 months automatically when she applies for Medicaid. So the attorney says, let's do a $100,000 spend down or community spouse annuity for Carl over the 14-month penalty period because that creates great synchronicity. So we do a single premium of $100,000 over 14 months. That's going to give us a monthly payout of $7,200 to Carl. So that's the thing here that we have to think about. It's a little bit different than what we normally do with a gift annuity. We're doing the gift already was made before they came into your office. We're getting that money back to Carl every month at $7,200. Carl's the owner. Primary beneficiary is the state, to the extent of benefits paid on behalf of Linda. So we always want to remember kind of how those beneficiaries have to be named and then their trust should be contingent. So we know Linda is going to be penalized for 14 months. We couldn't do anything about that. We can't cure that gift. But what we can do is increase Carl's income from the annuity and then we'll use Linda's income and then Carl can take the money from the annuity to pay Linda's cost of care of $7,800. And then whatever money's left, Carl can just keep that, because he's the community spouse. The couple was able to qualify in 14 months after the penalty period, rather than just waiting out the penalty period and then spending the rest of the money at the nursing home. And then Carl's receiving the excess income from the annuity to supplement his lifestyle in the community above and beyond what he has to pay for Linda's care. So again, that one's a little bit more straightforward. It's just kind of keeping all the characters in place on that one. But basically kind of the bigger idea here is Carl is receiving the annuity income and then paying Linda's bill and then just keeping whatever is left over, because one of those rules is once we get Linda qualified, the state's no longer interested in what the community spouse's assets are. So even though his assets are going to continue to grow, that's okay because we've already got Linda qualified for Medicaid benefits. Okay. Basically, the takeaway from this webinar for you is hopefully there are many instances where your case facts aren't going to fall within those traditional Medicaid compliant annuities. And we are more than happy to work with you and think outside the box to figure out how we can create the best results for your client. If you do have these cases, give us a call. If you see us at a live event, come to our booth. Let us just help you help your clients. If you like these types of courses, we do have more of them available on our Attorney Access platform. We do have a free version. Then we have our premium version, which gives you access to more CLEs, and that's $79 a month. So if you want to watch more webinars like this, where we kind of take some different concepts and kind of play with them, you can access those on demand on our Attorney Access platform. Okay, so that was a lot. I will take a breath here, let you guys type some questions in, and then I'll answer those. Kimberly asks in the questions, how would you advise Robert if he didn't have anyone he wanted to gift his assets to? You recommend charities at that point. Kim, I might just tell him you don't have to do any Medicaid planning. Spend it all at the nursing home. go buy some cool stuff. You know, there's other spend down strategies outside of using an annuity if you don't have anybody to gift that money to. Or maybe say, hey, I have a great charity that I'm passionate about. You want to make a gift to that charity. But for the client's best interest, what I always recommend is what's going to increase the quality of life for that client. So if the client's a big sports fan, let's get him the biggest TV that fits in his nursing home room. Maybe he has a family that visits and wants to take him out, and maybe Robert's in a wheelchair. Let's get him a wheelchair accessible van. You can usually have one automobile of any value in most states. Those vans can be very expensive, but they also allow Robert to go get out of the nursing home, go to the park, go out of Denver, go maybe for up to the mountains, being able to enjoy getting out of the nursing home in a way that is comfortable. I always think of that one because I was on a walk and I saw, I think it was a child or somebody younger trying to take care of an older person, but they had a sports car and they were trying to jam that wheelchair into the back of a hatchback of a sports car. So that really resonated with me. We've always mentioned that it was a great spend down, but actually watching it happen on the street kind of really made that one resonate with me. So I'm sure there's other things that we can find for Robert to make his life better. And then if not, you know, tip the nurses at the nursing home, and I'm sure they appreciate that. Let's see. Let me read through this one. Have you ever seen one of their news? That was one. Okay, so the question here from Lucas states, Jim, have you ever seen or heard of one where the beneficiary receives inheritance, okay, from a spouse that died? Okay, so we have that inheritance, should be a lump sum amount. And we tell Medicaid, and Medicaid does not kick the beneficiary off. Any suggestion for that? That's tough because it feels like you're kind of getting away with something, but Medicaid's usually going to catch up with that. So I would kind of just make sure that you're not spending that money would probably be my best suggestion there, is put that money aside. So when Medicaid, whoever's reviewing that file, maybe the caseworker's kind of out to lunch, or maybe they're new, they didn't know how to handle that, I would assume that that's going to come back around. I think if you polled 100 attorneys how to handle that, you'd probably get 100 different answers. The most conservative approach would be, hey, tell Medicaid again. I think other attorneys would say, no, did your job. Just make sure that you've done your duty to report it. It's on Medicaid now. Just make sure that if Medicaid does catch on at some point, that you're ready to go with the strategy that we talked about. But yeah, that's a tough one because I always assume Medicaid is going to catch on, and your duty is to report it. You've done your duty. So yeah, I think that would probably be my suggestion. Just make sure that money is not just getting spent, but you're just kind of holding it and so that you're ready to pull the trigger, because I'm sure they're going to, you get in and think about all the crazy things they would do, the request back pay, who knows? So just be prepared, but having that money in place, I think, is the best way to be prepared for how Medicaid's going to react when they realize that they have been overpaying. I know there's a big deal with that, like Social Security now, of overpayment and then trying to claw back that money. So Just be prepared. Yeah, no problem, Lucas. Like I said, I think if you ask 100 attorneys, you'd probably get 100 different answers there. All right, guys, that's all the questions I'm seeing. I hope you enjoyed this webinar. It was really fun to put together. It was really fun to kind of stretch my brain on some of these concepts. Again, if you ever have a case like that, reach out to us. We're more than happy to work through. Again, our planner sees cases all the time, and we want to be kind of a member of your team. Again, for the CLE, we will log off here right now, fill out the survey. If you have other topics you want to hear about, put them into the survey. Let us know how we did, and we will see you soon. And again, I thank you so much for being here, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you again, Jim, for your great presentation. And thank you to everyone for joining us today and for completing that post-webinar survey. Have a great afternoon, everyone.